tonight on Arena. It's movie night with reviews, early Irish film nostalgia and an interview with film star Joan Allen, star of Zero Day on Netflix. Tonight, Netflix launches a new miniseries called Zero Day. It's a political thriller starring Robert De Niro in his first ever TV role, playing George Mullen, a well-respected former US president. Following a devastating 60-second cyber attack that causes massive damage and destruction across the United States, shutting down the country and resulting in thousands of deaths, Mullen is charged with heading a zero-day commission with unique powers to find the perpetrators of the attack.
Please, what's the matter with you? This is exactly what they want us to do.
Who's they, Molly?
You don't even know who they
You're
are.
You're right. I don't know who they are. Neither do you. None of us do. But if we keep shouting at each other like this, what are we going to accomplish? We're Americans. What are we doing? We're supposed to be standing up for each other. We're supposed to be helping each other. What, you think you're doing the right thing? No, you're not. You're afraid. And you think if you get worked up over some bullshit conspiracy nonsense that that won't make you afraid? No. You're not behaving like an American, nor a patriot. You're here standing up for the little guy, the working man? Well, there are working men and women buried right beneath our feet, right here. You don't trust the government? I get that. It hasn't always come true for everybody, but this isn't about the government or the 1% or whatever the hell you want to call them. It's about somebody out there that hates us, that stands against everything that we stand for, everything that makes us who we are. And they found a way to hurt us. It's that simple. And right now, these people need to get back to work and get those people out. And you need to let them. You want to stand by and offer your support and your prayers? That's great. But please, just do it from behind the barricade.
Starring Robert De Niro, Joan Allen, Connie Britton, and directed by Leslie Linka Glatter, Joan Allen plays Sheila, Mullen's loyal and supportive wife and former First Lady, who in her own legal career is in line for a place on a federal bench. It should be her time, but events get in the way. And I'm delighted to be joined on the line now by Joan Allen. Hello, Joan. You're very welcome to Arena.
Thank you. Joan,
this is a gripping thriller with real world connections. I know you are quite selective in the roles you take. What had attracted you to Sheila Mullen, wife of former President George, played by Robert De Niro?
Well, a lot of things. I think the overall writing of the entire piece was very engaging and gripping, and the people involved, Mr. De Niro, and the other actors were very appealing, and the wonderful director, Leslie Glatter, who directed all six episodes, was very important to me. It was wonderful to have her on at the helm for every episode. I felt there was a great deal of continuity, and her research and work, I felt like I had somebody I could really trust and go to with my questions and the character development and our work together. And it was just a wonderful crew. It was shot locally, so I could go home sometimes on the weekend, which is also appealing. And it was just a very well-written, suspenseful thriller.
Every network ran it, even the Death Star.
I got carried away. I shouldn't have gone down there. I definitely should have kept my mouth shut.
You were great, George. Someone needed to say it.
President Mitchell just called. She wants me in D.C. tomorrow.
For what?
Didn't really say. Photo op in the Oval, maybe. Who knows? But I promise I'll be back for tomorrow night. Federal judge, second U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals. The vote may have been postponed, but we're going to celebrate.
I don't care about tomorrow night, but don't underestimate Mitchell. She was counting on these next few months to make her mark before the election, and now her entire legislative agenda is on ice until this gets resolved. She's not wasting her time on photo ops. She's calling you. She sees an angle.
It's simple. Today was the beginning and the end of my political comeback, period. You're running with the ball. Now it's your time. You stick to the deal.
You got out clean, no matter what anyone else said then or since. We both know how big a win that was. Don't forget what it's like under that spotlight.
I know. Now I'm just a struggling author dealing with the deadline. I've got nothing left to prove.
Whatever happens tomorrow, don't let him tell you otherwise.
Now, just to dig into the plot a little, as we said, you play the former First Lady, Sheila Mullen. Can you explain the effect the catastrophic cyber attack has on George Mullen and your character, Sheila? As I said, it had been Sheila's time to shine. She was going to become a judge, but George literally grabs the spotlight away from her.
Yeah, well, that's a pretty big occurrence that's happened. When everything shuts down across the whole country, she understands. I think she has been around politics her entire, well, for many decades. We established in the backstory that at one point George had been the governor of New York State, and so this is all backstory that we used as actors to before we actually went on set and did any of the scenes. And so she understands the gravity of the situation. And I believe she believes in her heart that he is the only person who really is equipped to take it on. And as a result, I think she is very pragmatic and understands her judgeship is going to go ahead at some point, but this is a much bigger issue and has to be dealt with somebody that is trustworthy, and she certainly believes that he is.
Now, that's interesting about the backstory that you developed as actors before the filming. In relation to the relationship between George and Sheila, what kind of partnership is it?
I think they're both in it together. Leslie emphasized that as we were working, that she is their partners, and that he really trusts her opinion, her perspective on issues. There's a great deal of mutual respect and admiration between the two of them. And I think they've been through a lot. They've had a long, long relationship, many, many years of being together. They've suffered great triumphs and a lot of tragedies. And I think that kind of history between the two of them has really cemented them together, and they have made choices. I think there are probably times in their relationship where it could have been like, we're not going to make it, but they've chosen to, and they've chosen to stay together. And I think a lot of that is a great deal of mutual respect and belief in each other's political perspectives, what they share. I think very similar ideas about what they think is the overall good for the country, what sort of policies should be enacted, et cetera. So I would say it's a very close partnership.
And of course, Sheila notices things other people don't notice. And we as viewers know that this zero-day commission is in the hands of George, this former president, as you say, so trusted by all of America. But you notice that things in his demeanor are going awry.
She does notice. And as dedicated as she is to him, she, I feel, believes very strongly that the right thing has to be done. If in some world he is not capable of leading the commission, she would want to know. And she would be, I think, certainly in favor of him not doing it. I think she believes in the greater good for the country. And if it's with him, yes. If there is something going on with him that makes it not for the greater good of the country, we need to talk about it and we need to reevaluate what is the best thing to do. I think she's extremely pragmatic.
Yes, and very self-sacrificing, it would seem, from us observing, because she asked Valerie Whitesell, who used to be Mullen's assistant when he was in the presidency, to come back to help him through this very difficult job of being involved in the Zero Day Commission.
I need you to do something for me.
Sure, I can. What is it?
I need you to go back to work for George. Sheila. The world has changed in ways he doesn't understand, and he needs a trusted ally by his side.
I don't think I can see my way to doing that.
Well, if I can see my way to letting you go back to work for him, you damn well can see your way to doing it. You are my friend. You owe me this. They say they want him to find the truth, but I'm worried whose truth and what they'll do with it once they have it.
Do you think he's being set up?
No, at least I don't think so, but I know he's surrounded by people who he can't trust and who I can't trust.
But you trust me.
in no way but the one that matters. I can trust that if you thought he could be hurt by this, or someone has an agenda, you would do something about it. You would protect him.
I would. It's the job.
Lily must be 12, right? Chapin?
Yeah.
I'm asking you to do this. Help him. For me.
That is a tricky one for you, because there's obviously, we think, as viewers, some kind of pass between Valerie yes. and the president.
Yes. There is a past. And I also think a lot of time has passed since that, since some of those trickier parts of the working relationship. I think that has a way of healing people. So not that you completely get over things, but there are scars. But I think also, again, I think she thinks very protectively and pragmatically about what is the best thing for George to do, for the best people to surround him. I think she's a political animal in a lot of ways. So I think while it may feel self-sacrificing, I think I don't see her as a martyr. I see her as very grown up. And I think she has her eyes wide open. And I think she makes choices based on what seems to be the best overall choice to make.
I'm interested, as you, as an actress who started out your career in Steppenwolf, a company we know well in Ireland from coming to Galway Arts Festival,
yeah.
and of course De Niro, who would have started out in the Stanislavski school. What's that like coming together? What's the acting space between you?
Acting space is terrific. I feel in the Steppenwolf tradition, I was sort of trained in my 20s to think of the story is the most important thing. Whatever you do as an actor must contribute to the story, because the story is ultimately for the audience to have an experience. And so conveying that is the most important thing. So you need to stay fresh, you need to stay open, you need to be real, you need to look at your fellow actor every night, because the people who are watching deserve to hear the best story that you have to offer that night, at least. I did so much theater in my 20s. And it created a kind of openness and not wanting theater to be static. You set your performance after rehearsal and it's the same every night. We didn't work that way. And I think Bob has a great deal of openness and playing with what is in the moment. And I felt like that was very compatible with the two of us. There's a lot of trust. It's like you try this time, I'm coming with you. Maybe that doesn't work. We'll try it again another way. And it's fun. It's very freeing to work that way.
Sorry, I got held up. I think that's the last of the stragglers.
You deserve more. We'll make up for it when it's Chief Justice.
It was fine, George. You must be exhausted.
So?
No question. It is a trap, politically. Mitchell has to take decisive action, and she knows that there is a good chance that half the country will end up hating whoever takes this on.
I can't let that stop me.
You are the smart play.
Everyone says that they want the truth, but the reality is it's better for both sides if the blame can't be pinned on anyone. That way they can just keep on blaming each other.
Is that your analysis?
No, that's our daughter. She says they're weaponizing the crisis.
We both know she can be prone to hyperbole. Mm. Though, in this case, I don't think that comes close to capturing it. This commission is the single greatest affront to civil liberties anyone has ever attempted.
Okay, well, that's it then. I tell Mitchell, no, I'm not going to do it.
That's why you have to do it. They've already weaponized it. And who else do you want with their finger on the trigger?
And obviously you stay on script. Is there any improvisation on the script?
Not really. No, we did very little on this. Not in this one.
Yes, I guess, as you say, you have to follow the story, and the story is propelling itself forward at some rate.
Yeah, there's a lot of plot in this series as well.
Joan Allen, thank you so much for talking to Arena.
You're welcome. Thank you. A pleasure.
My thanks to Joan Allen, who stars in Netflix's brand new political drama Zero Day, which streams on Netflix today. And on Arena Now, it's time for film reviews. It's family drama all the way this week, with a missing husband and father in I'm Still Here, twin brothers finding a homicidal new toy in The Monkey, and two sisters in trouble in rural Ireland in September Says. Walter Salles, director of Central Station and The Motorcycle Diaries, returns with the Oscar-nominated I'm Still Here, the true story of Eunice Paiva, a Brazilian woman whose activist husband, Rubens, was brutally disappeared in 1971 by the military dictatorship. Next, The Monkey, based on a short story by Stephen King, is a comic horror film in which twins, Hal and Bill, unearth a vintage toy monkey at the same time as a series of mysterious deaths start to occur. The twins grow apart as adults but have to come together 25 years later when the killings start again. Finally, more sibling drama in September Says, when sisters July and September, following a rough time at school in Britain, end up in rural Ireland. Dee Malumbi and Joe Griffin have been to the movies for us and they join me now. You're very welcome. We'll start, of course, with I'm Still Here, as a lot of Oscar nods here. Directed by Walter Salles, it stars Fernanda Torres and recalls a brutal time in Brazilian history of the 60s and 70s, when a right-wing coup threatened the citizens and supporters of the left. Do you give us the historical context here?
Yeah, so our setting is 1970 in Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. This is kind of following on from the 1964 Brazilian coup d'etat. So we see, like, you know, military vehicles kind of driving around the place, kind of disturbing, I suppose, what would otherwise be quite a peaceful scene. So there's a former congressman, Rubens Paiva, and this is all based on a true story, by the way. He's just returned home after 6 years of self-exile. His tenure was revoked, and he basically lives this quite idyllic life with his wife Eunice, who is played by Oscar-nominated actress Fernanda Torres. They have five children. They live in this absolutely stunning house. It is by the beach. You can see the children kind of running down to the beach, playing. There's a little boy who kind of takes in a dog that he finds in the streets and everything. But their world really comes crashing down when a military raid takes place in their home one day, which results in kind of the arrest of Rubens, and kind of, yeah, it really breaks down, I suppose, this peaceful family life that's been established.
Yes, Joe, I think Walter Salles said that he was a teenager in 1971 and he knew the family and visited this wonderful house that he has captured so well.
Yeah, it's interesting to think that in the early scenes you see some of the kids from the family playing football on the beach together with other kids from the neighbourhood. And I imagine that Walter Salles was one of those kids who played soccer on the beach with those guys. It shows the kind of environment that Salles and that the family grew up in, middle class, liberal, creative community. And
yes, there's music. There's the walls are lined with bookcases.
Yeah, the music, the soundtrack in this film is fantastic. There's pop music and rock music from the era, both from within Brazil and without. The father at one stage gives out to the kids for listening to gringo music, he calls it. Okay. Like the French and American pop music that comes through the speakers. So there's a lovely sense of time and place and location. As one of my favourite things about the film is that it feels like a 70s movie, not just because of its setting, but because of the look. It has a lovely warm cinematography. It was shot in film. There's a lot of 8mm, which gives a lovely immediacy to it. And then, of course, loads of films from the 70s were rightfully very paranoid. So it has that kind of paranoid atmosphere of people calling to the house, representing the government, just asking questions. So, yeah, it's a period piece that feels like it could have come out during that period.
Now, there's a scene where the authorities raid the house and they take Rubens away. And then Fernanda Torres, Eunice, the character of the mother and the wife, is left really to hold the fort. Mm-hmm. What kind of demeanour has she got? Is she feisty fighter or is she very protective? what approach does she have to their dilemma?
Yeah, Fernanda Torres, it has to be said, gives an absolutely incredible performance in this. She got an Oscar nomination, and actually, would you believe it's the first time in almost 50 years that two non-English performances have been nominated for the Best Actress Oscar. Her and Carla Sofia Gascon in Emilia Perez was also nominated. So I think what Torres does so well is how much of her performance is kind of happening beneath the surface. You can see her kind of smile, give that smile that you know there's so much kind of concern and fear behind, as like, you know, we would associate with so many matriarchs, kind of holding it all together for the sake of the children, you know. But there is a lot of fear there. There is a lot of confusion there as she is watching her husband be taken away. But at the same time, she's trying to stay calm and that there's nothing to worry about for the sake of the children. And I suppose later on in the film, as she's trying to like figure out, you know, exactly what happened with her husband, she has to maintain that demeanor, even though there's more kind of fear and uncertainty in their lives than ever before. So I think Torres really deserves a lot of credit for her brilliant performance here.
And how is the outside world, this military dictatorship, portrayed in the film? Do we see a lot of that, Joe?
We see as much as the filmmakers intended, which is, I think, that it's opaque. So there's a really good scene in the first act when Ruben's taken away and Eunice is asking questions and being taken by the same authorities. And the withholding of information and the mystery behind everything that should be more straightforward, that the legal infrastructure is just not there. So a lot of the film is about asking questions, about seeking truth, even if it can take decades. So I think Salas and the crew and the filmmakers held back as much as possible. Even when people arrived at the house, they don't introduce themselves properly. There's a veil of mystery, almost consistent, almost to the end.
Yes, we know about those military coups across South America and the disappearance. Like, people mainly didn't come back. So is there that awful fear the Rubens is gone, is dead?
Yes, that fear is definitely there throughout the film. And it's funny, as I was watching this movie, I couldn't help but think of like our own Irish history of kind of the disappeared. And I'd wonder if this film would end up kind of striking a chord, particularly with an Irish audience, given our own history with that. So yeah, there is a lot of fear there. And I think it's really interesting that you see how Ruben's disappearance impacts all of the family members. So I spoke a bit about Eunice, but also they have these five children, and they're all different ages. And you can see the three older of the daughters, they're quite involved. They're asking a lot of questions. They're really striving for the truth. And I suppose they're almost kind of forced more so into adulthood than the two younger ones, who just kind of accept everything like the way it is, accept what their mother is saying, you know, as truth, though. So I thought that was a really kind of interesting aspect to it as well.
So overall, Joe, stars out of five, did you think it was a gripping story about this kind of heroic woman and her husband who is taken?
Yeah, I thought it was really substantial. I really liked it. 4 stars for me.
4 stars from you and from you, dear.
4 stars from me. My only criticism of it would be that we learn kind of a bit more through like titles at the end of the film what happened to Eunice later on. And I would have kind of liked to see that incorporated into the movie, just because she led such a fascinating kind of political career in her later life. But it's still a really great movie. 4 stars.
4 stars from both of you. That's from I'm Still Here. Next, a serious change of tone in the splatter horror film The Monkey, directed by Osgood Perkins, son of the famous actor Anthony Perkins. Identical twin boys Hal and Bill find a new toy to play with, a monkey who unknown to them has homicidal tendencies. 25 years later, the killing starts up again, and now the estranged brothers are forced to take the creatures on. So let's have a clip from earlier in the film, I think. Here, Hal and Bill, played by Christian Convery, get some morbid facts of life from their mum, played by Tatiana Maslany.
Everybody dies. And that's life. I'll die. And you will both die.
and all of your friends and their parents and all of their pets and everybody.
Some of us peacefully in our sleep. And some of us
horribly, violently, tied up with clothesline and
screaming through duct tape over our mouths and all that jazz.
And to hell with it. Come on, let's go dancing.
Yeah, tough words of warning there from the mom, played by Tatiana Maslany, and Christian Convery plays both of the boys there, Hal and Bill. So, Joe, this is a film of two halves. Hal and Bill as kids are played by Christian Convery, and then as adults played by Theo James. Bring us into the world of the monkey.
Yes, so I'm a big fan of in horror movies when weird artifacts turn up. The opening scene is actually one of my favourites in the film, where their father is trying to get rid of it in this shop of mysterious and ugly knickknacks. The monkey, you might have seen variations of this toy, although they keep insisting on the film that it's not a toy. It is a toy. It's a wind-up monkey. You would have seen it using symbols in the Toy Story variations, and they actually, in the original short story, it was using
it's
symbols.
The Stephen King short story.
Yes, but Disney apparently owned the copyright to a cymbal clanging monkey, so this monkey drums the drums instead, which is very ominous. And so it's kind of a mystery horror in which the twins, now grown up, played by Theo James, are trying to, there's a more moral twin and a more amoral one. And the moral one is trying to track down this monkey to make sure other people don't turn the dial and the monkey drums. And when the monkey drums, something bad happens. So it's kind of a mystery, black comedy thriller, strong shades of Final Destination in the elaborate Rube Goldberg death scenes, which were the highlight, if you like that kind of thing.
And it's based on a Stephen King short story. So are there lots of nods to other work that we'd know from Stephen King?
Absolutely. I mean, even from hearing of the story construct in that it follows these two characters when they're boys and later in adulthood will be very reminiscent, I think, to anybody who's seen, the two-part movie It, or the TV movie version of that. That whole idea of childhood trauma kind of revisiting the individual as an adult is a very strong theme that Stephen King utilises in a lot of his work. It's set in Maine, same as It. It obviously incorporates horror elements. Bullying is a big theme in it. Hal is at the mercy of both his twin and some very nasty girls at school. There's an absent father. You've got discussions around puberty. The kids watch this educational video on the subject matter. So a lot of the kind of tried and tested Stephen King tropes are there. And I suppose maybe that's partly why Osgood Perkins kind of wanted to take on this movie. Stephen King is such a well-known, figure and everything, but this probably wouldn't be one of his best known works at that.
Now, it's always tough when there's a change of actor, isn't there, halfway through a film. The Christian Convery is, I think, very strong in the first half, and this then it is handed over to Theo James. How does he pick up as the older twins?
I think he was fantastic in this, actually. And you might know Theo James from playing rich jerks or alpha kind of bully types in things like The White Lotus, where he has been really effective and he's very conventionally good-looking leading man. Whereas in this, he's more of a kind of Clark Kent figure. He's more socially awkward and he's constantly terrified. And my favourite moments of his acting is when he is reacting to something horrific that has just happened. He's got a great shriek, much better than I expected when I'd seen him in other things.
Were you happy with both incarnations of the twins?
I actually didn't like Theo James's performance, if I'm honest. I thought Christian Convery, in fairness, was very good, and he had quite a lot to kind of carry in that first half of the movie. But I thought Theo James was quite weak as the grown-up Hal and Bill. As the lead character, I just found him a bit dull, a bit uninspiring, and I know that's partly meant to be his character, but at the same time, when you're the lead, you don't want a character that's quite that dull.
Stars out of 5 for the monkey from you.
I thought it was quite fun. 3.5.
3.5, okay, not quite sure. What about you, dear?
It fell apart a little in the final act, but it was also quite funny and entertaining, so I'll give it 3 stars.
3 stars, that's for The Monkey. Now, finally, from brothers to sisters now, and more trauma in September says. July and September are the siblings in question. They have very intense bond, but September is the boss. Bullying at school moves the family from England to Ireland, where things take a turn for the worse. Award-winning French actor Ariane Labette makes her directing debut here, and she'll be talking to us on Arena on Monday night. Let's hear from the sisters and the control September has over July. September is played by Pascal Kahn and July is Mia Thuria.
September says, turn around. September says, touch your nose with your tongue. Do 10 push-ups. You lose life.
Don't leave me.
September says, engrave my name on that window pane.
That's Pascal Kahn there as September and Mia Thuria as July. So it's this intense relationship between the two sisters. It's a thriller? Is it a horror film?
It's kind of tough to categorise it. I suppose you'd call it like a family drama slash mystery, because there is this intensity to the relationship. And even in moments like that where you're just kind of sitting there and she's like, you know, cutting into the window, like it really kind of gets to you. So maybe like psychological drama would be the best way to describe it, I suppose. The relationship between September and July, I have to say, absolutely hooked me. Now, I do have 3 younger sisters myself, so I very much related to the weird sisters element.
Are you going to tell us which one? Are you a bully September?
Oh no, I'm not admitting that on air. But yeah, so September in the relationship, she's very controlling, and she can be a little cruel almost. You know, she's the one that bosses July around. She makes up the games that they have to follow. But at the same time, you can kind of respect the fact that September is so like that she stands up for July against all the bullies when there's no one else there kind of to defend her and stuff.
And Joe, horrible things happen to July. She is very bullied at school and some of it's very violent.
Yeah, it's quite a hard and stressful watch at times. And not to be flippant, but funnily enough, last week, twice I wrote School is a Horror Movie, like in my notes for 2 separate films this week. And also like The Monkey, the sibling is both an antagonist and a protector during some of the exchanges that happens. Yeah, it's a hard watch. Other Stephen King parallels, even though this is not Stephen King related, is Carrie. It reminded me a bit of, with the cruelty meted out like to teenage girls who don't quite fit in. So it's also quite a modern and relevant take, because sadly some bullying is aided by technology, as mobile phone correspondences can up the ante.
And Ariane Labette, the director, is an actress. Mm-hmm. And she does get very good performances out of her actors in this.
Yes, out of both the actresses who are playing July and September, Mia Thuria and Pascal Kahn. And actually, it's kind of a 3-prong movie. We have to mention here as well the 2 girls, their single mother, artist Sheila, played by Iraki Thakrar, who some people might recognise. She was in the next Netflix series, Sex Education. But she's kind of the third lead in this movie. And she's really at a loss with how to handle her girls. And she's an artist herself. So all she's doing, I suppose, is trying to love her daughters and to create this kind of, you know, protective environment from them, from the outside world that doesn't really respect their uniqueness. So I think the writer-director, Ariane Labette, she based this movie on the book Sisters by Daisy Johnson. She really gets three phenomenal performances out of those actresses. And I just love her direction here. Like small moments like we heard in the clip there with the carving on the window, having a few drinks in the pub or a child's game just carry such intensity and such emotion. And you're absolutely hooked and compelled as to what's going to happen
stars
next.
Stars out of five from you, Dee.
I'm going to give this 4 out of 5 stars. I really thought it was fascinating. And it shows what these kind of like low budget co-productions can really accomplish.
I get the feeling, Joe, you didn't like it so much.
Not as much. I respected it a lot more than I liked it. 3 for me.
3 from you. Well, my thanks to Dee Malumbi and Joe Griffin. I'm Still Here, The Monkey and September Says opens in cinemas tomorrow. I'm now joined by Morgan C. Jones. Morgan brings to life the remarkable stories of his great-great-uncles, Barry Fitzgerald and Arthur Shields, in his play The Quiet Men. These two legendary Irish actors made a significant impact on both Irish theatre and Hollywood, with Barry becoming an Academy Award-winning star and Arthur leaving an indelible mark through his work with the Abbey Theatre, his roles in classic films, as well as fighting in the GPO in 1916. I'm delighted to be joined in studio now by Morgan C. Jones to tell us more. But first, let's hear the opening theme from the 1952 film The Quiet Man, a film that the brothers both starred in. Oh, it brings you back to St. Patrick's Day viewing. Morgan C. Jones, you're so welcome. So your play, The Quiet Men, is inspired by these two great uncles, Barry Fitzgerald and Arthur Shields. They have different names?
They have different names, yeah. Barry changed his name. He was born Will Shields. And he changed his name for that most basic of reasons. He was working for the civil service and he didn't want to be found out and lose his job. So by day he was Will Shields when he was working in the Labour Exchange, and by night he was Barry Fitzgerald doing his dream job. And then when his dream job became his full-time job, by then he had just morphed full-time into being Barry Fitzgerald. But when he was working in the Labour Exchange, that's when he would have befriended Sean O'Casey, when O'Casey and himself used to hang out, and O'Casey apparently would bring him around pubs where he'd seen various characters and go, do an impression of him, Barry, do him. And that's where the Paycock came from. You know, he was kind of written by O'Casey for Barry.
This is Captain Boyle.
Yeah.
Yes.
And when he wasn't hiding behind his stage name, he was having a full night drinking.
Yeah, because what you're describing is, like, we know Barry Fitzgerald from Going My Way and again from The Quiet Man. But obviously he had this wonderful career in Dublin before he left for Hollywood.
He had a remarkable career, but it was a career that was predated by his younger brother, Arthur. Arthur went into the Abbey first. He would have joined the company there in 1914, became a full member around 1916. It was in 1916 that Arthur came back from a theatre engagement in Britain and got the orders to mobilise, because he was also a member of the Volunteers. So he very kindly popped into the Abbey to tell the stage manager that he might not be able to make the matinee that day, retrieved the rifle that he'd hidden under the stage at the Abbey, and went down to join the Volunteers in the GPO.
So he was in the GPO with Connolly and Co.
Yeah, Connolly actually, when he mustered with Connolly at Liberty Hall, Connolly knew my great-great-great-grandfather, Arthur and Barry's dad, Adolphus Shields, who was one of the unsung heroes of the Irish Labour movement. Adolphus was the man who invited James Connolly to Ireland. I'm sure he would have turned the letter away had he known what was going to happen. But when Connolly saw Arthur, he said, Shields, if you're as half as good a man as your father, you'll be all right. And that was his welcome into the fighting for Easter week. But he wound up being interned in Frangach. But when he came back, he wasn't radicalized by his, not that they were radicalized, but Frangach was certainly like a training ground for what the Irish nationalist movement became. Arthur wanted really no part of it because he was tired after 18 months of listening to the Our Father being said in Irish. He had neither Irish nor prayers to give. So he pursued his heart and his dreams and became an actor as well, full time.
Now, in your play, one man show, The Quiet Men, you portrayed the younger brother, Arthur, as very... as somebody who minds and looks after the elder brother. Is that based on fact?
That was certainly the case. They were devoted to each other, but Arthur, even though he was the younger of the two, was certainly, he was more in the caring role. Barry, he kind of felt it was his job to mind him. Not that Barry was a babbling idiot, no more than any other actor is, but he had a very, I suppose, a strong fraternal, almost paternal attitude towards him, but they were certainly devoted to each other.
Now, Barry Fitzgerald, as you said, there was good friends with Sean O'Casey, and that the Peacock was modelled on their relationship. But he went on also to play a part in The Plough and the Stars, and he was there when the riots broke out about the Plough.
Both of the brothers were there when through all of those massive historical occurrences in the Abbey. When, you know, that night, you know, you've disgraced yourself again, Yeats, and all of that. The two brothers would have been on stage for that. Arthur was very much a protege of Yeats. So he was much closer to the nuts and bolts of the actual day-to-day production of theatre production in the Abbey. We have a letter in the family archive, where letters between Yeats and Shields, where basically Yeats says, you know, you can go off, pursue this thing in Hollywood, but there's always going to be a job for you when you come back in the Abbey. And then, unfortunately, Yeats died. So either way, he probably would have had to stay in Hollywood anyway.
So how did these two actors, one a part-time revolutionary, the other a part-time in the civil service, come and go to Hollywood?
Well, they were part of a number of very successful Abbey Theatre tours of America that took place between 31 and 39.
So obviously the Abbey Theatre was extraordinarily famous at that stage with its connection with Yeats and Lady Gregory.
100%, yeah. They were most favoured guests culturally invited to the States. And Arthur actually would have been the stage manager for those tours, as well as being on stage, or the tour manager rather than the stage manager. So he was known as Boss Shields. He clearly was able to... boss people about, but in a very gentle and considerate way. But he was a great organizer as well as being a great actor. And certainly it can't have been easy, you know, no matter how devoted they were to each other, having one being so much more successful and more famous than the other. But it didn't seem to mar their relationship.
Just tell us a little bit about how successful Barry was when he got to Hollywood.
Well, in many ways, he wound up defining the stage Irish persona, the film Irish persona. He pretty much defined how the Irish clergy are portrayed on film. And that's still kind of, there's still traces of Barry's performances in a lot of Irish priests you'll see on American movies and TV.
Yeah, because Going My Way was a legendary movie, with Bing Crosby playing the young curate and then Barry playing the older, I think, Father Fitzgibbon.
Fusty old Father Fitzgibbon, yeah.
And it was about their relationship really developing and a kind of love growing between them.
Yeah, and a great fondness. And of course it had the Oscar-winning song, Swinging on a Star. Barry, for the 45 Oscars, was nominated for both Best Supporting Actor and Best Actor for his role as Father Fitzgibbon.
So that was just a thing then.
Two nominations in the same movie. He's the only actor, man, woman or child, to be nominated twice for the same role in the same picture in the same year. And when he won Best Supporting Actor, within hours, the Academy changed their rules to make sure that nobody could ever do that again. So he's the only man with that distinction.
Well, and it swept the boards, didn't it? So Bing Crosby then was free to win Best
Oscar. Best Actor. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, poor Barry knocked the head off his Oscar years later, well, months later, playing golf. Because the Oscars they got during the war were made of plaster because of metal redistribution. So I touch on that in the play. I touch on various things in the play.
Yes, because in there they had interesting private lives as well, Ben.
Yeah.
Boss was married a number of times.
Three times. His first two wives both passed quite young due to complications around alcohol consumption. Certainly Una O'Connor, who was known professionally as Aideen O'Connor, Boss's second wife, she was the love of his life. And very sadly, she passed about 6 or 7 months before they came back to Ireland to make The Quiet Man. So it's worth bearing in mind when you watch The Quiet Man, not only was Arthur, but with Boss acting, playing Reverend Playfair, he was also masking his absolute dejection and despair at losing the love of his life only months earlier. And their daughter was probably about 5 or 6 at the time when Una passed away. So... And I know what it's like, as a lot of actors would know what it's like when you have to go on stage even though you've lost somebody you love, or you have to film when you've lost somebody you love. So that's one of the things that attracted me to the story as well, because it's having some kind of an insight as a performer to know what goes into it. Because you play people that you'd never meet or want to meet in real life, but you play them truly and faithfully. And you also bury whatever's going on in your life while you're doing that. So that's what I want to kind of bring a touch of that to these guys' story.
And now we think of now, and you know, a few years ago when The Banshees of Inisherin was made and all the Irish actors coming back to you know, act in that. But at the same time, back in 1952, when John Wayne and Maureen O'Hara came, and then Barry Fitzgerald and Arthur Shields, it must have had the same buzz about the place.
I think it would have been a massive buzz, because, you know, it was very unusual to have Hollywood visiting Ireland for, you know, I mean, I think the next big thing that came after The Quiet Man was Ryan's Daughter, and that was, what, 25 years after.
And do you know, did it mean a lot to them to come back to be in this movie?
It meant a huge amount. It would have been very bittersweet, particularly for Arthur, because he'd always dreamed about getting back to Ireland with Una, and that just didn't happen. Couldn't happen during the war years because it was unsafe to cross the Atlantic in case you got torpedoed. So it would have been very bittersweet, but it would have been a massive thing for them to come and see family and see home.
Tom from Kildare says, I can see Barry with reins in hand on my black and white TV in my mind on a cattle drive, 4 horses, a great actor, he says.
Thank you very much.
I mean, I know it was thought of at a time like stage acting, but when you see him now, you just think, what a great actor.
Yeah, I mean, there was... kind of wrote the rule book at a time when mass media was in its infancy. And people kind of think, you know, younger people might think, oh, well, you know, Hollywood and the Irish connection begins with Paul Mescal or begins with Colin Farrell or Brenda Fricker. Barry and Arthur were there right at the very beginning and trailblazers. So, and unfortunately, things that happened in the past get forgotten. Things that happened before the internet never happened as far as, you know, a lot of people are concerned.
And now Barry remained single all his life, and then he eventually died here in Ireland.
He passed away in Ireland in 1961. From complications from a head injury he got as a very young boy playing rugby. But he was also suffering from Parkinson's. So he passed away here and is buried in Dean's Grange. Arthur passed away in Santa Barbara. 10 years later, was cremated, and his ashes were buried beside Barry. So they were devoted to each other in life, and they devoted to each other still.
Well, to find out more about The Quiet Men, Barry Fitzgerald and Arthur Shields, you can go and see The Quiet Men by Morgan C. Jones, and that will be on at Smock Alley on Tuesday the 25th and Wednesday the 26th of February as part of the Seen and Heard Festival. More details from smockalley.com. I'm sorry, Morgan. Thank you very much. That's it for tonight's show. Research was by Paula Shields and Leah Murphy. Mark McGrath was on sound. Ollie Hamilton was the broadcast coordinator, and the programme was produced by Reg Luby. John Creedon is next.